Well, today, as we move into the season of Advent, we're beginning a new series this morning called Love Came Down. And about a year or so ago, I was reading an article in Relevant Magazine by Rob Bell, and he was talking about the importance of the season of Advent that we're now moving, that we're now in. And he kind of led into the importance of Advent by talking about the relationship between sound and time. Which, you know, two things that I don't, where is that coming from? Sound and time, the relationship between the two, and what that has to do with Advent. And so I want to try to borrow from that, unpack that a little bit, because I think it's really helpful for us as we think about and as we prepare to move into this time. So first, a quick word about sound. Let's say, hypothetically speaking, that I have a hammer. And I have a board. Well, I had a board, but I couldn't find a table to put it on. So then I found this wooden TV tray. I was like, how did they know? That's exactly what I needed. Now, how many of you would agree that the sound of hammering, like on a board, on wood, is kind of annoying, right? Especially like over, it's random, over a loud duration of time. It's kind of piercing. How many of you have ever been awakened by the sound of, early in the morning, a nearby roofing or a construction crew? Right, it makes you crazy. It's horrible. It's annoying. Now, a snare drum, check this out. A snare drum really isn't that different, right, from a hammer. Now, why is it that one sound can be incredibly... I don't need that anymore. Can be incredibly irritating, can get on your nerves, can be this loud, this racket, it can give you a headache. And then other sound, if it's done, okay, intentionally with like a sequence, with a proper pattern and a proper order, can be something very, very different. This will never happen ever again. So if you need to Instagram this, now's your time. Right? That's all I got, but I mean, it's something. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. So why is it one type of sound can be grating, irritating on your nerves? The other, if produced intentionally, can become kind of a groove. It can be this rhythm. It can have beat. It can have meter. It can become something more. Case in point, take your common air conditioner or refrigerator buzz. Right? How many of you are like, I would love to hear more of that, please? Your dog called, by the way, and said, that's how loud it is all the time. It's just one sound. It drones on and on. There's no break in it. It has very little, if any, like dynamic range. And so it's just this continuous noise, that flat noise that goes on and on, hour after hour, day after day. So sound can be grating. It can be irritating. Or when intentionally produced at like regular intervals, becomes something else that we call music. Now, the difference between music and, say, hammering, the difference between music and refrigerator buzz, it's the intention regarding the rhythm, the beat, the meter, the pause, and the rest. It's knowing when to play. It's knowing when not to play. One more example, you can take musical notes, like on a keyboard or a piano, and notes like this, the C scale, just descending, okay? Just kind of boring, kind of lifeless. There's no real shape. There's no real form. It's not really what we would call, music. It's very uninteresting. Yet, when you take those exact same notes and you play them in the exact same order, yet you give it some pause, you give it some rest, it becomes something completely different. But, okay, now this kind of ends the talent show portion of this sermon. I can also juggle, and I'm available for kids' birthday parties, but... Okay, so it's noise, it's sound, but it's the particular arrangement of the noises and the sounds that make it what we commonly refer to as music. It has shape, it has flow. And in the hands of like actually skilled musicians, so not me, and vocalists, it can become something beautiful. It can become something incredibly moving. It can become something like this. Two kinds of noise, two variations on sound. One we call music, the other we call refrigerator buzz. Okay, that's sound. Now, time works in a similar way. Time can, if not broken up properly with rhythm and beat and meter, develop a sort of metaphorical refrigerator buzz. Now, how many of you, this sounds vaguely familiar? Wake up, eat, walk dog, check clock, change diaper, pack lunch, change another diaper, email to-do list, check your calendar, grab purse, backpack, briefcase, stop for gas, do laundry, make phone call, check email, make plans, work, sit in class, eat, work, study, practice, go to meeting, breathe, present, take walk, go to hardware store to pick up tiny light bulb, email, text, cook meal, clean, brush, sleep, repeat. How many of you know exactly what I'm talking about? It's already trash day, and that was like 2 days ago. And where did November go? See, time, if it's not broken up, and we have these routines, we have these schedules, this is what we do every Wednesday afternoon, this is my morning routine, this is my kind of regular thing at night. And if we're not careful, our days can become like a living equivalent of refrigerator buzz. Now, the Bible begins, interestingly enough, with a poem. Genesis 1:14 says this, and God's doing the talking. It says, "Let there be lights in the vault of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years." Now, that word seasons to people in the Bible, that actually meant something. It wasn't just, in other words, like the four seasons that we have. It comes from the Hebrew word moedin, and it means appointed times. It's the way in which we interact with time. And so the poet says, there are these movements in the sky of these celestial bodies, the sun, the moon, the stars, and they serve to help us kind of mark time. And so obviously the sun and the moon mark a day as 24 hours. The cycle of the moon gives us like the month. The sun and the earth gives us the year, breaks things into years. And so this breaking things into segments, breaking things into different parts. The point of this, and we'll see in a larger biblical picture, the point of it ultimately was to create space to interact with God, create space to meet with God. Because if you don't break up the days, if you don't have a sense of rhythm, beat, meter, pause, I mean, what can easily happen is life develops a sort of droning on and on kind of buzz, just a kind of deal. Now, we've all experienced sort of the low-grade despair that comes when every day is like the day before, that comes when days blur into each other and everything starts to feel the same. Take, for example, the story of the Hebrew slaves in Egypt. Life in Egypt was comprised of making bricks every day, all day. Bricks, 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 eat, sleep, more bricks. That was what you did all the time. Tomorrow will be just like today, more bricks. And so for the Israelites, being rescued from the Pharaoh, it isn't just a story of God rescuing people from having to make bricks all day, every day. Because when God rescues them, he gives them these commands. One of the most important commands being, take a day, a week, a Sabbath that is not like any other day. A day without bricks. He says, 6 days you shall work. But on the seventh, on the Moedin, on the appointed time, do no work. Now, why is this so huge? Because God gives them this rhythm. Not like the rhythm of sound, but the rhythm of time, the appointed time. See, life before this was this never-ending succession of sevens, right? Seven, 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 seven. God steps in, he says, I want to break this up. I want to give you a bit of rhythm. How about 6 and 1? Let's try 6 and 1 and 6 and 1. Life needs rhythm. It's what makes one moment different from another. It gives shape and color and form to all of life. And without it, something very destructive happens to our joy. Without this rhythm, something happens to our peace, to our understanding of what it means to be a human being. There are several other examples in Scripture. I'll just give you one more. The theme of this, though, that begins to emerge is that as people interact with God, they begin developing kind of a calendar. They begin developing this way of breaking up the year so that it's not this long, continuous, monotonous, droning buzz. That's why in the Old Testament, things like the festivals and the feasts were so important. Numbers 9:2 says, "Have the Israelites celebrate the Passover," which was a huge feast, "at the appointed time," the Moedim. And you'd stop what you were doing. You'd examine your life. You'd look at your heart, your relationship with God. And most of all, you would eat and feast. You guys with me now? Yeah. You look into your past. You kind of look at where you're heading. But you'd stop what you're doing. That was the point. Otherwise, your days will all blend into one another. Now, what does this have to do with Advent? Thank you for asking. Because Christians, for hundreds and hundreds of years, they've understood this idea of appointed time. They've realized that time, just like sound, is best when it's divided up, when it's broken up, when it's arranged into patterns and rhythms. And so, over time, they created this church calendar. They created it to give us space to meet with God. It's a way to organize the year, to bring shape and variance to our days. It's a way to find the song, the rhythm, in the passing of time. And so Advent, then, specifically, is about anticipating the birth of Christ. It's about longing, desire, that which is yet to come, that which is not here yet. And so we wait expectantly. We wait together because all is not right. Something is missing. We take an entire month. Advent is traditionally the four Sundays leading up or before Christmas. We set those Sundays aside to prepare our hearts to receive Christ, this newborn baby, as King. As Meister Eckhart said, "What good is it if he came 2,000 years ago if he doesn't continue to come today?" Luke chapter 1, if you have a Bible, I invite you to turn there. Luke opens up his gospel with what I think is the best example in the spirit of anticipation, waiting, longing. The best example in the Bible of what this looks like, entering into this rhythm of Advent. Luke 1, beginning in verse 5. Luke writes, "In the time of Herod, king of Judea," okay, that'd be the Herod that killed or later killed all the boys, baby boys in Bethlehem. "There was a priest named Zechariah who belonged to the priestly division of Abijah. His wife Elizabeth was also a descendant of Aaron." So what he's saying is both Zechariah and Elizabeth come from the priestly line. It goes way back to the time of like Aaron and Moses. I mean, Zechariah's dad was a priest, his grandfather, his great-grandfather, I mean, all the way back. Both of them have that kind of long, long line of religious leaders that they come from. Verse 6, "Both of them were righteous in the sight of God, observing all the Lord's commands and decrees blamelessly." Now, the writer here, Luke, believed that, like, when God looked at this couple, he thought, they're doing this right. I mean, they're righteous. They're obeying my commands. I mean, all the commands. If you've ever read the Old Testament, that's a lot of commands, right? But we don't even like to read through it because it's so complex. Here's a couple who was following all the commands blamelessly. And here's where we pick up some tension in verse 7. "But they were childless because Elizabeth was not able to conceive." Okay, that's great. Let me get this straight. You're getting up day after day. You're serving God in the temple, following his commands. And this God you're so faithful to leaves you without an heir, leaves you without kids. And in this culture, women usually got blamed for infertility. I don't mean to be offensive, but in this culture, women had like no political clout almost. They were almost always uneducated, generally couldn't work. And so having kids was like the main kind of role duty for women at this time. Not only that, but there was a religious stigma attached to this It was thought that God granted children, so he decided who could and who could not have kids. And so there'd be this sense that God, for some reason, has cursed Elizabeth. Perhaps she's done something wrong. So then Luke, almost as in a paradox, begins by saying she's righteous, they're both blameless, but they were childless. They were blameless. I mean, throughout her young years, throughout her middle years, throughout her later years, in spite of her faithfulness, it was clear this wasn't going to happen for her. And the last line is they were both well advanced in years. It was over. It was too late. I mean, we later find out in the story that they had prayed the desperate prayers, like any couple who wants to have a child. And God had apparently said no. And Elizabeth had lived with the shame of this, the pain of this, all the way into her old age. Now, here's where this gets ridiculous. Their entire determination to be faithful to God, to do the right thing, to be those kinds of people, was based on a promise God had made like 2,000 years before the time of the story. 2,000 years ago, before this, like 4,000 years for us, God had made a promise to Abraham. And apparently this is what God said in Genesis 12. He said, "I will make you into a great nation," which that did actually happen. "I will bless you. I will make your name great," which that pretty much happened. Most of you heard about Abraham before you came in here this morning. And here's where it starts to fall apart a little bit. "And you will be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you." Okay, that happened for a while. "And whoever curses you, I will curse." We're still trying to figure that one out. "And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you," you being Abraham, his descendants. So this was kind of the root idea behind why the Jews believed there was something more for Israel. Abraham did indeed father a nation, and it grew, and they got their own land, and the kingdom was established. And generations later, King David, right, came along. It was the golden age of Israel. Then after David, Solomon. I mean, things were incredible. If there was ever a time for this last part, "all peoples on earth will be blessed," if there was ever a time for that to actually happen, it would have been during the reign kind of David or Solomon. Because right after them, right after Solomon, things fell apart. The kingdom split into two. There were wars. There were some good kings, but lots and lots of terrible kings. From the time of Solomon up until the time of Zechariah and Elizabeth, check this out. Israel as a nation changed hands 25 times. The Syrians took over, the Babylonians took over, the Persians, the Greeks, and here they were occupied again. Half the time they didn't have an army. At one point, they were taken away from their land for 70 years, like this mass sort of exile. They were becoming less and less and less a factor in world sort of events. And so the idea that somehow the entire world would be blessed through this nation that had no leverage, that had no money, that really had no say-so in their own future, the idea that that would happen, I mean, not only was it not happening, it couldn't happen. And then to add insult to injury, in 65 BC, Pompey the Great, this Roman general, went into Jerusalem, again, occupied at that time, went into the temple, past the priest, walked straight into the Holy of Holies, the place where Jews believe God dwelled. Walked into the Holy of Holies, the place where only the high priest could go one time a year to serve before God. The place where if you went into the Holy of Holies unannounced, uninvited, they believed God would strike you dead. And the priest gasped as Pompey the Great walked straight in, looked around, walked out, and nothing happened to him. And so word spread throughout Jerusalem. News quickly spread that apparently Jupiter, the god of Rome, is more powerful than the god of Yahweh, or the god of Israel, Yahweh. And so Zechariah would have been a little boy when that happened. Zechariah probably remembered the time when his dad came home, who was a priest, right, working during that era, came home like white as a ghost, mourning, tearing his robes because the temple of Yahweh had been desecrated by a Roman general who walked into the Holy of Holies, walked out, and God did nothing. And yet this little boy, with that in his background, grows up still believing, still holding on. He goes into the priesthood. He marries Elizabeth. They together, they know this story. They remember the sacrilege. They remember this emotion of why didn't God act on our behalf? And why doesn't God act on behalf of Israel? And what about Abraham and his promise, God's promise? And how in the world can this tiny conquered nation ever be a blessing to the world like God promised when it's like barely managing to survive, to like stay in existence? And so during this time, what happened is lots and lots of Jews turned away, like in masses. Many turned away from temple worship. They just walked away. Many turned away from their belief in God. They gave up. They sold out. Lots of people integrated into Jews, integrated into Greek, Roman life because it's over. I mean, if you'd gone to Zechariah and Elizabeth this time and said, it's a myth. It's over. It's not going to happen. It was fun while it lasted. Some nice stories, you know, back there that we can tell our kids. But that's it. Nothing can come from this dusty corner of the empire that will impact the world. Enjoy the few remaining years you have. Because God, if there ever was a God, has abandoned you. And so the reason Luke begins his gospel with this particular story is because here's a couple that was doing what they were doing as priests and as followers of God based on these promises God had made centuries earlier. And 700 years had passed, and it seemed like since the time of Solomon and the division of the kingdom, and it all started to go downhill. 700 years, and it seemed like God had done nothing for the nation of Israel. And yet these two get up day after day, and they live their lives as if actually the Messiah is coming, as if God is actually going to fulfill his promise. Again, no evidence that God is going to do any of that. And Luke is saying, this is the beginning of something brand new that would ultimately result in the fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham. Now, look at verse 8. Once when Zechariah's division was on duty and he was serving as priest before God, he was chosen by lot, according to the custom of the priesthood, to go into the temple of the Lord and burn incense. And when the time for the burning of incense came, all the assembled worshipers were praying outside. So they had these 24 groups or divisions of priests, 18,000 of them in total. And Zechariah is chosen. He goes into the place and stands right outside the curtain that divides the Holy of Holies from the main part of the temple. It's a very, very sacred occasion. It's an incredible honor to be chosen. I mean, they believe God was in the kind of casting of lots, and so God picked who got to have this honor. You might get this opportunity if you were a priest once in your lifetime. Everybody else vacates this part of the temple, and Zechariah is standing all by himself in the temple as he offers this incense to God. Verse 11, then an angel of the Lord appeared to him, standing at the right side of the altar of incense. When Zechariah saw him, he was startled and was gripped with fear. But the angel said to him, this is awesome, do not be afraid, Zechariah. Your prayer has been heard. Hey, some of us would just like to hear that every once in a while. Would you agree? Not even that your prayer is going to be answered, just that like it's registered, it's logged somewhere, it's been heard. I mean, how many of you would like just once in a while for their, you know, for like an angel to show up? Just like a little one, mini one. Not a big scary one like usually happens in the Bible. And just say, we got it. For God to whisper, hey, your prayer has been heard. And that would be so helpful. He says, your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you are to call him John. It's going to be a famous John. John the what? John the Baptist. He will be a joy and delight to you, and many will rejoice because of his birth, for he will be great in the sight of the Lord. He is never to take wine or other fermented drink, and he will be filled with the Holy Spirit even before he is born. Many of the people of Israel he will bring back to the Lord their God. Which, why would he have to bring them back to God? Because many have turned away. Many have given up. Many have given into despair and to cynicism. Many had abandoned God and in their minds had good reason to do so. And he hasn't done anything, they would say, for 700 years. It was over. He will go on, verse 17, before the Lord. in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the parents to their children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous. That's a quote from Malachi 4. To make ready a people prepared for the Lord. Now look at this, verse 18. Zechariah asked the angel, "How can I be sure of this?" And he gets kind of diplomatic here. Check this out. He says, "I am an old man and my wife." Well, my wife is, how shall I say this, just in case. This is getting written down. Okay. My wife is well along in years. Yes. In other words, I'm glad you've heard our prayer. That's nice. But like you're a tad late. And we prayed all through our 20s. And we kept praying in our 30s. And, you know, maybe odds are decreasing, but we prayed in our 40s. Like in our 50s, we even offered a few half-hearted prayers. But now I'm old, and my wife, Sarah, she is old too. And the angel says to him, I love this. The angel says to him, "I am Gabriel," for starters. That part's not in there. "I stand in the presence of God, and I have been sent to speak to you and tell you this good news." I'm Gabriel. You're talking to an angel, and you're wondering how in the world this is going to happen. "And now you will be silent and not able to speak until the day this happens, because you did not believe my words, which will come true," this is my favorite part, "at their," what's the word? Say it with me. "Appointed time." You mean God knew he was going to do this all along? You mean like those 700 years that went by, God was waiting on purpose? You mean God watched as people abandoned him in droves and went other places and gave up and gave into despair? You mean God watched that happen, knowing he was going to do this? Yeah. I mean, God's planning this whole time, this appointed time, that even though God had been like silent, that doesn't mean that he's been inactive. You've heard not only my prayer, but the prayers of the people generation after generation. Yep. At the appointed time. Which means that, among other things, God's sense of rhythm, God's sense of timing is a little bit different than ours, isn't it? Yeah, we don't always know the lead sheet or the score or whatever it is that he's playing off of. Like the notes are invisible or inaudible, or I don't know how it works. It's sometimes different. Now let's finish the story, verse 21. Meanwhile, the people were waiting for Zechariah and wondering why he stayed so long in the temple. It's not supposed to take long, just incense, come out, we can go about our business, but they're waiting and waiting. When he came out, he could not speak to them. They realized he had seen a vision in the temple, for he kept making signs to them, but remained unable to speak. Verse 23. When his time of service was completed, he returned home. After this, his wife Elizabeth became pregnant and for 5 months remained in seclusion. "The Lord has done this for me," she said. "In these days, he has shown his favor and taken away my disgrace among the people." See, that was just the warm-up act. That was just the opening band. This was just evidence that God was gearing up to do what God had promised to do all along. What those who had remained faithful, generation after generation, who had died and never seen fulfillment of the promise, but still passed on to their children the hope that Messiah will come, that God is a God who keeps his promise, that he can be trusted. And finally, the day had come when God would put into action what he had planned to do since he had made this promise to Abraham, that every nation, that all peoples on earth would be blessed. Now, Zechariah and Elizabeth, their appointed time, in many ways, is our appointed time. In many ways, applies to us. Because it goes on and it marks the beginning. It marks the arrival of Jesus, Emmanuel, God with us, the one whom the angels said would be good news of great joy for all the people. And so the reason that we enter in to this season, the reason we pause, we break for Advent, is because our world in many ways is not all that unlike the world of Zechariah and Elizabeth. Because this is our story, isn't it? This is our dilemma as well for many of us. Do we stay or do we go? Do we believe or do we stop believing? Do we serve or do we just go do something else? Do we give or do we just spend and know there's nothing beyond what we see around us? Do we stay engaged, or do we do what so many other people are doing, walking away, giving up hope, doing it their own way? Because cynicism and despair are like the new religion of our world. And this religion teaches that this isn't as good as it seems, that it will let you down, it'll betray you. I mean, give it time, you'll see. And we get burned and we get bruised, we get betrayed, we get knocked around. People and institutions let us down. Authority figures disappoint us. Relationships dissolve. We start things that are new, and for a time it's exciting and things are going great, and then it falls apart. It wears out, and it becomes something that disappoints or hurts us. And so what often happens is our heart builds up these layers of resistance. Our hearts get like calloused. And we gave ourselves to somebody. We gave them everything we had. We loved them. We opened up, and then they hurt us. And there's something in us that says, never again. And a bit of our heart starts to die, starts to close. And so I'm here to say, Advent is a season where we open ourselves up to God, and we ask God to come into those places where we've lost the ability to be filled with wonder and awe and anticipation. We ask God to go in there and to heal and to transform and to reconcile and to put broken things back together. Joseph Bottom says this, and I know it's an unfortunate last name, but he says, what Advent is really is a discipline, a way of forming anticipation. It's a way of forming anticipation because it's space, it's room, it's a rhythm, it has a beat. And what can easily happen is we lose the ability to be surprised. We lose the ability in a religion of cynicism all around us to be filled with wonder and awe, to be genuinely anticipating and grateful. Isn't this why we love to give kids presents at Christmas time? Just watch them tear them open, right? And what do they do when they tear open the presents? It's like, oh, there's like this reaction, this awe, this surprise. Is it possible that the reason that brings us so much joy is because we see in them something that we have lost over the years? Are you with me? And so when it comes to anticipating a birth, for some of us what happens, we lose the ability to anticipate. That sense of, oh, something's coming. It becomes, no, it'll let us down just like everything else has let us down. I want to invite the band to come up, the worship band, and we're going to spend a little bit of time in reflection. I've got a few more things, some questions, and then we'll spend some time in worship. Advent is a month where we become hyper-aware, we become hyper-focused, acutely sensitive to the ways in which our heart has taken blows and bruises. Advent is this space where we invite God. We invite the resurrected Christ to work there, to meet us there in all sorts of new, fresh, resurrecting kinds of ways. It's a season of waiting. It's a season of expecting, of longing. Without which our life becomes a constant noise of activity. Without it, without this time, actually let me say it this way, Advent is this time that helps us step out of this and experience a little more of this. It's room. It's space for us to meet with God. And so we ask God to move in all those places we've been kind of knocked around. We've become cynical or bitter or frustrated. So that we might have the same. A couple of questions. Is there any hardness, closeness, coldness in your heart? Is there any area of your life where you've lost the ability to be expecting? Because, you know, it's going to go the way everything goes. Is there any area where despair is slowly creeped into your life? An area where perhaps you wonder, God, do you even hear my prayers about this? Am I the only person here who, over time, finds myself naturally getting more cynical? That other people are never going to change, that I can't change no matter how hard I try or what I do. Yeah, this affects all of us. It just kind of slowly spreads and seeps into our hearts. Is there anything that you've been waiting for, and your waiting has turned to frustration and despair? And so we invite God into that. Rob Bell says, Advent charges into the temple of cynicism with a whip of hope, overturning the tables of despair, driving out the priests of that jaded cult, announcing there's a new day and it's not like the one that came before it. The not yet will be worth it. Advent whispers in the dark. Would you stand with me? Advent confronts this corrosion of the heart, this insistence that God has not abandoned the world. It insists that hope is real and that something is coming. It says in these moments, in these seasons where we wonder, God, where are you? Are you listening? Are you active? Do you even care? Advent prepares us for the reason, the response that we hear at Christmas, which is a resounding yes. Yes. Would you pray with me? Lord, I pray this morning that you would remind us that our hope is not in vain, that our faith, our trust in you is not misplaced. Lord, I ask that you would give us courage like Zechariah and Elizabeth. Help us to be men and women who are confident that you keep your promises, that you are with us. Lord, help us to enter into this Advent season, the rhythm of this appointed time. Lord, we ask that in those places where we've fallen asleep, that you would wake us up, that you would open the places that we have closed. We ask you to melt our cynicism, those deepest places of bitterness and hardness. Would you revive with awe and wonder? And so, Lord, we turn our hearts in the direction of that day. That day when the baby cries his first cry and we, surrounded by shepherds and angels and everybody in between, celebrate that sound in time that brings our spirits what we've been longing for. In Jesus' strong name we pray. Amen. Well, as you grow this Advent season in the discipline of anticipation, may you find that your despair, your cynicism, your frustration is overshadowed with awe, with wonder, and with hope. Grace and peace. We'll see you next week for part 2 of Love Came Down. Mm-hmm.